Papers. Here on Radio 4 FM, our Book of the Week, journalist Lloyd Bradley's Sounds Like London explores the different styles of black music that have arrived and evolved in the capital during the last 100 years. Today he brings us right up to date and shows how grime broke through from underground raves to take the mainstream charts by storm. The reader is Ben Onwukwi.
On Friday, June the 25th, 2010, just as the build-up to the England versus Germany World Cup quarter-final was gripping the entire nation, the man who pushed grime into the mainstream, Dizzy Rascal, exploded onto Glastonbury's main stage. Wearing an England football shirt with Dizzy 10 on the back, he was instantly one of the weekend's biggest hits.
Bonkers.
Some people think I'm bonkers, but I just think I'm free. And I'm just living my life, there's nothing crazy about me.
That he could rock this particular house was hardly surprising. Here was a man who had grown up emceeing East London raves, in which there was nothing separating those on the mic from those who had paid good money to get in. Nimble, crowd-pleasing skills were a basic survival tool. Dizzy's Glastonbury set was significant as an unequivocal, live televised marker of quite how much a mainstream rock crowd had accepted a sound that, a decade previously, was all but unknown outside certain parts of London. Dizzy had become the poster boy for a subterranean London black music movement that had been simmering on pirate radio, in raves, on sound systems and in specialist record shops for the best part of 20 years. Grime's choppy rhythms and deep bass beats, overlaid with an MC's rhymes in a distinctive London patois, all began with a deliberately forbidding music style that had enough of a sense of irony to call itself jungle. All through the 1980s and well into the 1990s, the mainstream remained largely untroubled by the evolution of black British music. That's not to say there weren't underground developments elsewhere. For some time, a new breed of club promoter had taken over the warehouse party scene, making the most of sound system technology to blow it up into massive outdoor events. It was becoming so widespread as to be the default setting for an entire generation of British pop kids. Naturally, this scene produced its own music. Add to that the technocentric tidal wave from Northern Europe, crested by Black Box, Snap, and Technotronic, and pretty soon there was a new addition to rock's rich tapestry, the genre now officially known as dance music. As the 1980s rolled into the 1990s, the notion of black Britishness became more delicately balanced. A large proportion of those coming of age had parents who were born here, and multinational backgrounds that could include two or three Caribbean islands and more than one continent. Add to that mixed race as London's fastest growing ethnic group, and for many youngsters, back home was what they saw out of the window. The capital's constantly evolving street slang provides the best illustration. Jamaican patois remained its foundation, but it included at least as many hip-hop references and a grab bag of long-standing Londonisms. You could visit three different time zones within the space of a sentence. That this vernacular was in use by kids of all races further muddied the cultural waters. Of all London's post-80s black music genres, jungle is probably the most underappreciated and the least understood. It succeeded where other styles had fallen short and, by providing a bridge between large-scale rave culture and the specialized sound system world, it created a sustained black music scene that was open to everyone. Jungle bypassed the record companies, swapped conventional music media for flyers, and replaced Radio 1 with tower block pirate stations, enough to elevate jungle to a point at which, during its 1994-1995 peak, it was pop chart regular and yet seemed to maintain its outlaw status. While the lack of regulation may have been creatively stimulating, this free-for-all entailed inevitable copyright problems and the cavalier attitude to sampling hastened the demise, with producers moving into drum and bass, and by proxy pop music, which was no longer using reggae sampling. A wave of influential newcomers brought a spectrum of black backgrounds into drum and bass. Goldie, the jungle-influenced graffiti artist, LTJ Bookham, who is a classically trained pianist, once had a jazz funk band. It now became an in-concert proposition, vital for grown-up rock world success, as acts performed with instruments and bands rather than just record decks. With the style's name readily accepted across the pop and rock worlds, it put these guys right into the mainstream mix, producing music that won accolades, sales figures, and credibility in equal amounts. Annie Nightingale and John Peel championed the sound on Radio 1. Ronnie Size's Represent Posse won the 1997 Mercury Music Prize with their New Forms album. And in what must be some sort of mark of distinction, David Bowie messed about with drum and bass on his Earthling album of that year. This was London, or at least a meaningful part of it. Despite its sociological relevance and musical appeal, however, jungle and drum and bass was soon to be eclipsed on the London underground scene when Garage staked its claim as the street's rhythms of choice. The origins of the garage sound lay in New York's Paradise Garage Club in the early 1980s, where legendary DJ Larry Levan span original house music blended with soul, funk, salsa and disco. By the second half of the decade, that kind of soul-infused house was making a considerable splash on the dance scene over here. Suddenly, record shops were awash with fast, skittering tunes that didn't really acknowledge a black London heritage and weren't looking to develop the music. To the relief of many, it didn't last too long and was replaced by two-step, the underground's answer. This new, unique pattern fed into a cauldron along with hip-hop, rap, soul, reggae, dancehall, and of course, drum and bass stroke jungle to create what became UK Garage. Between about 1998 and 2000, it was all over the place. It was around this time that the garage scene evolved into a state of apparent high bling, a clubland metaphor for conspicuous consumption, champagne designer clothing, fancy cars and pole dancer-style women. The videos and lyrics that began to dominate the mainstream end of the genre came to define the image of UK garage, and also reflected pressure from the record industry, which was using the more visible end of the US rap spectrum as its benchmark. This process spectacularly imploded when acts like So Solid Crew appeared to buy into the clichés and spent more time in the dock than in the charts. And while sections of the press seized upon gunplay in nightclubs with worrying enthusiasm, the style itself was shooting itself in the foot. As influential dance music producer Dave Jones explains, in 1999 in London, there was a garage committee formed by DJs, producers and promoters. It was done in a very mafioso way, and if you weren't invited, you weren't allowed in. They used to tell people what they could play and what they couldn't play, who would get booked at whatever venue. Garage had stopped behaving like sound systems and driving itself forward with innovation. A generation of young DJs and producers was coming up who were relegated to the back rooms of raves, if they got a gig at all, but being away from such main hall pressures allowed for greater experimentation. The music forming was dubstep, a dub reggae approach to two-step, stripping it down to its bare bones, then building upwards from a big bass line, leaving enough space to incorporate other elements. It created music that could be shaded in any way the producer fancied, but would always have a compulsive, heavy core. The major problem was that this scene lacked a focus. These contemporary sound men didn't have regular venues where they could feed off each other or build a crowd. That's where Club Forward, one of contemporary London music's most important establishments, comes into play. It was the brainchild of Sarah Soldier Lockhart, who achieved at least as much for the scene as any DJ or producer. Around the middle of the noughties, dubstep became omnipresent. The style was strong enough to build anything on top of it. Artists from Eminem to Radiohead commissioned dubstep mixes of their work. But while dubstep was wowing the world, the juggernaut that is grime was gearing up to redefine British pop music for the 21st century. Grime has turned characters like Dizzy Rascal and Tiny Temper into superstars. It grew up almost parallel to dubstep, with the simple difference that it was far more instinctive and anarchic. Original grime was its own reward and could afford to be entirely self-referential. It was under minimal commercial constraint, and taking part was the most important thing. Such immediacy had an evolutionary effect on the vocals, which moved on from Jungle's essential, albeit heavily Londonized Jamaicanisms, to the capital's almost ubiquitous youth speak. So pan-racial were these tones that two generations on from the Windrush arrivals, it was now not only impossible to tell what a person's roots might be, but whether, unless you could actually see them, they were black or white.
Yeah, yeah, we bring the stars out. We bring the women and the cars out. Let's have a toast, a celebration, get a glass out. And we can do this until we pass out.
Alongside its more cliched urban audience, grime also attracted a growing subsection of middle-class fans, for whom it provided a suitably parent-upsetting, male teenage angsty alternative to the X-Factor fodder and shoegazing indie rock that had been clogging up the music business since the turn of the century. That they accessed the music via word-of-mouth illegal broadcasters gave it a level of playground urban cool that money couldn't buy. The first generation to grow up with the web, these guys were exploiting it mercilessly for showcasing, podcasting, and streaming. What do these characters need with a recording industry? A mere two and a bit generations on from Kitchener singing "London is the place for me" on the Quayside, London's black music, grime, has achieved the same sort of cultural status as hip-hop in the USA. The future for London's black music is possibly more exciting than its past. With the conventional music business falling apart, these new musicians have the skills to progress without that big money safety net. Now, more than ever, that unique black community experience, the sound system, is really coming into its own, as the internet and widespread pirate radio broadcasting make it available to practically everybody. But this is more than mere self-sufficiency. The constant creative experimentation and the fearlessness that drives it forward have always been the sound system's way of doing things. These have now installed themselves in the mainstream and will change the face of British music, quite literally and forever.
Ben Onwukwe was reading Sounds Like London by Lloyd Bradley. The book was abridged by Natalie Steed and produced by Kirsten Cameron.
From the epic poem by Virgil.
What could wound the queen of the gods with all her power?
I hate all the Trojan race.
Why did she force a man so famous for his devotion to bear such trials?
Escape now, Aeneas. Run.
The Aeneid.
Do not fight, Aeneas. Do not fight.
Starting on Sunday afternoon at 3 on BBC Radio 4.